Are there any direct questions, yes. Jim?
Does the picture of Glade have anything to do with the genie? Or do they, the Glade have anything to do with the genie at all?
No. The other physiological parts of the body have nothing whatever to do and can make no difference to the gene. The gene is a particle which is not affected by accident or by good living or bad living or anything of the kind. It's inherited completely. And it remains the same, except when it mutates.
Well, I was only saying this because when you get examples of very tall people, you know, about 7 foot, 8 foot, they say...
Right.
Yeah.
What I have to say, the original wheat is still there, Asia Minor. All wheat you know in England, America, Australia, wherever, is so much mutated, it can't stand competition, it's got to be pampered, and if you left it for true, if you left it go back to self-sown, as you know, on the English field, it would only last for 3 years, around that.
What are you talking about? A new hybridized plant or
well,
what?
It's all hybridized, mutated.
Yeah.
But say you just left the field, see?
Yeah.
Left it. It will grow.
It would revert to its original if it's left on its own.
No. It will grow 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It won't be in existence.
That's right. Well, you see, this is.
But it's Asia Minor. That's still wild wheat. Is still there. But you can't grow it outside of Asia Minor.
Well, you see, this is an example, to some extent, of what has been termed in modern times as genetic engineering. Because, to some extent, the domestication of animals and the hybridization of plants is a kind of genetic engineering which has been conditioned by picking out certain factors and breeding those factors in control of man. Man's been able to control that. As a matter of fact, in relation to dogs, you know that there are Great Danes and there are little tiny dogs, and there are bulldogs, and there are all manner of weird dogs that I've seen. Now, all of these dogs were derived originally from the wolf. You see, all of them. And they're variations of a species. They're all interfertile dogs. All dogs can mate. Unless, of course, a physical impossible. I mean, I can't imagine a Great Dane mating with a tiny little, what they call a chuchua or whatever it is. I mean, this would make it physically impossible. But genetically, there is no barrier. You see, what determines a species, among other things, is the genetic isolation. That's why when you get a horse and a donkey, you get a sterile hybrid. And most of these crosses of plants are sterile hybrids anyway.
Well, I hope that's answered that one. Next.
I'm sorry, you know, to enlighten you, you know, that it's not completely so that, you know, that a real large dog can it meet with another species very small. In fact, this happened very recently.
Well, I didn't say so. If I may say so, you weren't... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if I may say so, you weren't listening to what I said. I said that genetically, there is no barrier. The barrier, if a barrier at all, is a physiological one. Obviously, if you've got a Great Dane and a little chuchua, or whatever the hell they call it, it would be a bit of a job. I mean, I know
well,
that.
I don't want to... I think it's probably best if we deal with some of the points raised in the actual lecture. I don't want to let the You can go to the dogs.
Very good.
I'd like to come back to the fact, you know, from previous, you know, about being inherently genetically programmed. And as I see it, you see, there is a 1 in 4 factor, where the process seems to be, you know, that the female is the carrier. And the male species provides the gene. But it makes no difference, you know, whether it's the gene or whether it's the carrier. The 1 in 4 press still happens in both cases. Well, from that, you know, I would say that we are inherently genetically programmed, you see. Because if we've got to follow this 1 in 4 program, it means to say, even if it comes to a drastic situation, whatever, see, one gene or one carrier will come out strong enough, you know, to carry on.
Well, I don't quite get the gist of what you're saying. If I can interpret what you're saying, you're saying that there are genes that are carried. Apparently, they must be carried on the X chromosome. Well, this is quite true, but I mean, what point are you making? You see, the fact is that two germ cells carry half the number of chromosomes of an ordinary body cell. Now, when they unite, they become 23. Once again. Or rather, they become 46 once again. And the contribution, as far as genetic factors are concerned, the contribution comes from the male and from the female. Now, if a gene is heterozygous for a certain recessive element, then that element is likely to show up in the offspring. If it's homozygous, then it's swamped by a more dominant gene, and it doesn't show up. It's merely carried in the phenotype, which is the inherited organism, the organism that inherits the genetic structure. And this is what happens all the time. And there are very, very intricate. You see, it's not a simple proposition. I mean, I'm dealing with something. I'm using this because this is the kind of mechanism that you've got to take into consideration, whether you like it or not. This is an advance upon what Darwin and other evolutionists were talking about. And in fact, it validates and substantiates what they were talking about. And gives validation in a way which never existed before. In other words, it's showing scientifically how the intuitive reasoning of Darwin and company is correct. So you've got to consider it, but a study of genetics is very, very intricate, very, very complicated. And moreover, the study of molecular genetics is even more complicated. But the thing is that those sciences have been able to demonstrate much more clearly and scientifically evolutionary theory than ever any time before. What I was going on to say... pardon?
Sorry, there was a question when you were ready.
Yeah, was this. You see that what I do deny, as far as programming is concerned, is that according to the Lorenz and other school, Anthony Storr and various other people, who, by the way, are not charlatans by any means. I mean, even a racist like de Gobineau was a very, very cultured man. He was a writer of quite great talent. And so, to some extent, was Houston Stuart Chamberlain. Lorenz was recognised as a world authority, as an ethologist, an animal behaviourist. Can't say so much about Desmond Morris and Robert Ardrey. Robert Ardrey was formerly a playwright. Desmond Morris was an artist who became a zoologist. But nevertheless, Lorenz, at any rate, was a renowned scientist. But of course he was a specialist who was extrapolating from one specialised field and trying to apply it to human society, which of course has many, many pitfalls. The fact is, of course, that Lorenz was trying to demonstrate his results from a study of Gaelic geese, and apply it to human society, which you can't do. So what I'm opposed to is the idea, which is fostered by these people, that man inherits aggressive and acquisitive traits from the lower animals. He does no such thing, that man inherits this genetically and consequently is programmed for aggression, and it doesn't matter what happens in the environment. If you are genetically programmed for aggression, then there's nothing anybody can do about it. It'll occur. But, of course, I don't accept that at all. This is a completely erroneous idea. Man has no instincts, except those that are in relation to perhaps sex, eating, and so on, things like that. But survival. Well, survival, what do you mean by survival? Do you mean by individual survival or individual survival? Well, individual survival. Yes, well, individual survival, you see, is bound up with the survival of the species, particularly where mankind is concerned. More so than any other group, because mankind's development in history from a certain set of circumstances, he evolved with no specialized biological attributes in relation to survival, except his central nervous system and his superior brain, together with his ability to, what Rona Hurst says, all of these cumulative biological attributes which make man unique and different from the lower animals. The survival process on an individual basis has been effected by human cooperation. And if survival means what the racists say it means a ruthless struggle for survival, or so-called survival, on the basis of becoming a property owner or the exploiter of labour power. And that is what is meant by survival, as far as Mrs. Thatcher, de Gobineau, Hitler, Lorenz, all of these people. That's what they mean by survival. But of course, in relation to evolution, it doesn't spell survival at all. What it spells out, and more so now than any other time, is that if man doesn't continue to evolve on a more cooperative basis, then he's likely to go out of existence very, very quickly, because he's likely to carry out behaviour which is a much worse form of the kind of behaviour that he's carried out over the last 10,000 years. Of course, it's admitted that over the last 10,000 years we've witnessed the most appalling intraspecific inhumanity. That is a fact. And this, in my view, is one of the reasons why workers are so cynical. Workers, I don't think for one moment that most workers don't accept Marx's analysis of capitalism as far as He pointed out that capitalism was an exploiting society, that workers have got to always work for a living, they've got to struggle for higher wages, and so on. These things, I think, workers accept. What they don't accept is the proposition that anything better can be put in the place of capitalism. That is what they don't accept, and that is only an extension of the idea of original sin. The man is an aggressive, acquisitive animal, and that acquisitiveness is determined by his genetic makeup. I deny that that is the case. The fact is that this terrible intraspecific warfare, aggression, and appalling inhumanity of the period, which is a very short period in relation to the whole of existence, of only some 10,000 years, nevertheless, it's an example of human behavior, I would say, not because of human nature biologically, but in spite of it. And what we have to do, of course, is to square the circle, as it were, and bring into line human nature, biological human nature, with human behavior. At the present time, human behavior is very, very much separated from human nature, because there is no evidence whatsoever that man is an aggressive animal that's programmed genetically. There is no evidence at all that man has only one set kind of behavior. Man is capable, or mankind is capable, of all kinds of behavior.
Well, did you have a point?
Sorry, don't I?
Yes.
It's to do with man being able to change the environment, and therefore the effect of genetic mutation, you say, was predominant. Is that right?
No, the reverse is the case, as a matter of fact. Although, of course, there's some evidence to suggest that there is an interaction. As you know, that in the Pleistocene period, there were five glacial periods and four interglacial periods. And as a matter of fact, the Holocene, which is the period that we are now in, is considered by most glaciation scientists, as it were, to be one of the aftermaths of a glacial period. And in that period, there were tremendous fluctuations. And it's been suggested, of course, as I pointed this out in my talk about the emergence of man, that there was one discovery of fossil remains in France, which indicated that the fossil was an Eskimoid type. It's been suggested that Eskimos, because of the Arctic conditions, existed in Europe before they were driven north. But there is another theory that this Arctic condition did have an effect in bringing about mutations which were favourable to an Arctic state of affairs, like the lidded eyes, the more squat, the fact that larger animals lose heat much faster than smaller animals. All these factors are suggested might have been brought about by that. It's a sort of a two-way process. But the fact is that, generally speaking, mutations take place, and unless you know the process by a study of molecular genetics and know exactly the biochemical processes that are taking place, there is no reason why these mutations take place. There has been an assessment, and mutations take place in practically all plants and animals at about the same rate.
Yes, well, is that if I have a particular gene which may not allow me to survive in my present environment, I as an individual can alter my environment so I can survive. And this is, I think, is what man has done. He alters his environment, and he's been doing it quite effectively. But to continue that, of course, it's got a stage now, because of the vast amounts of industry and the speed with which it's going, that he's altering his environment so quickly that he doesn't know the effect of pollutants. And the pollutants could make his survival difficult. And in fact, in the future, the survivors of the human race may be only those that can survive those pollutants because of the mutations that are taking place. And so in fact, we might be.
Yes, I can see the gist of your argument, but you see, the fact of the matter is that it's precisely because man it's not been necessary for mankind, having reached a certain stage of biological evolution, to depend upon further biological advancement. Man, as you quite rightly say, has adapted himself to different environments, not by biological change, but by cultural adaptation, by being able to build shelters, by fire, by tools, and eventually, of course, with very, very complicated machinery like aeroplanes and electric power and so on. All this is part of a cultural application. So that the fact of the matter is, this reinforces what I said earlier, because this process of natural selection is a very, very slow process. And man can't wait. You see, it's quite unnecessary for man to evolve different genetic structures in order to survive. The argument that's used, and is used by some geneticists, that this is the case, ignores the fact that what they're saying is that mankind at the present time is not capable of solving his problems. He's got to wait until he's genetically improved by natural selection. Well, to me, this is utter nonsense. The fact is that natural selection is so slow a process that it can have no real impact at all. What is essential in relation to polluting the atmosphere and so on, and I appreciate what you're saying in that respect, but that is all under the control of man as he now is. There's no need for having any specialised biological advancement other than what we've got in order to effect that.
Yeah,
so
he doesn't realize it, he doesn't do it.
Well, I think then in that case that he'll just go out of existence. You see, various animals have lasted for... I pointed out, as a matter of fact, last time that the dinosaurs in the Mesozoic era, that's the middle era, lasted for 125 million years. And they went through all sorts of process of modification, none of which was any good. They died out. Man, with all his superior ability, is in danger with that superior ability of wiping himself out much sooner than the dinosaurs died out naturally. So, this is the...
You said earlier that no human behaviour is instinctual. You said with the possible exception of sex. I want to ask, doesn't that have to be learnt behaviour too?
Well, I think that all of these behaviours, to some extent, have to be learned. But there are, reflex actions, certain reflex actions are instinctive. Breathing is a reflex action. A neurophysiological reaction to light and to movement and to sound, in many respects, is conditioned physiologically and conditioned genetically. But the point is that it has no real significance in relation to man's social position. It has no real significance whatsoever. The real significance is man's ability to adapt with the equipment that he's already got. And those people that deny that are saying, of course, that man is the product of original sin. And it's original sin that threatens to destroy him. This is what they're saying. Those people who are waiting, including the geneticists, and some of these geneticists are very, very fascist-oriented. For example, the husband of this geneticist, Rona Hurst, when you read some of his books, he was in favour of what was happening in Germany, as far as genetics were concerned. He made a lot of other excuses. They weren't doing this and they weren't doing that. But it wasn't in relation to the main factor that the state was intervening, trying to build a superior race. In other words, he was oriented towards the kind of interpretation of genetics that some of the Nazi so-called geneticists were oriented to. And he's somebody that's a well-respected scientist from Cambridge and has all kinds of connections with other geneticists. You see, it's not confined to people that are charlatans by any means. And this is what we have to combat. You can't go and argue with scientists unless you know something about the science. If Lorenz makes an assertion about genetics, how do you argue it? You can't argue it on the basis of what, for example, Lewis Henry Morgan said about consanguine tribe gene society or gen society, or you can't argue the case from a purely political point of view. You've got to know something about what they're talking about in order to refute it. That's why I think it's necessary. And this is why I've undertaken what I've done. I think it's necessary for members of the party in particular to be aware of the kind of fields in which they meet opposition. Yeah. And you've got to know something about it.
Take a couple more questions.
But natural selection only takes place when there's an environmental necessity. Is that correct? If there's an environmental necessity. If, say, for instance, people were saying about pollution. Now, like different forms of insects have become immune to pesticides, things like that. Couldn't man become immune to pollution?
Well, no. You see, what you've got to recognise is this, that during the process, the succession of life, there has always been a struggle towards much better adaptation to the existing environment. When man started off on this process of cultural adaptation, of course he was in a very primitive condition. But as far as natural selection is concerned, man emerged in a far different position than the lower animals. Now, pollution does have a particular effect. There are other aspects of genetics which I haven't gone into, one of which is known as polymorphism. And polymorphism, to some extent, is a suspension of natural selection with the interference of artificial circumstances. For example, the peppered moth, Biston betuleria, which is found in various parts of the country, the one species produces a very, very dark kind of moth, and at the same time produces a light moth. And the reason why that particular factor continues to exist is this, that in certain areas, like areas of big steelworks, Birmingham and Sheffield and places like that, where lichen grows on the trees, and it's a light green, isn't it, lichen? The light-coloured moths, when they alight on the lichen, they're not seen very accurately by the birds, so they survive. Now, if they were knocking around, say, in Birmingham, round about Birmingham, and they had to alight upon the trunks of trees that have been blackened by smoke and soot, they stand out so that when the birds come along, they see them straight away and they nobble them. They eat them straight away. Now, what you have, therefore, is that you've got this mutant moth from the same species, one group, which survives more successfully in a place where the trees are blackened, and consequently they can't be noticed by the birds. And the other group that alight survive better in a country area where there's no pollution. So that this is one aspect of polymorphism. It's called industrial melanism. And then, of course, there's another one, which is a very common one, sickle cell anemia, which is a condition found in West African Negroes, which has a genetic effect upon the formation of hemoglobin. But there is another factor that the gene which is heterozygous for that recessive element is also resistant to malaria. So you've got a position where you have both these factors occurring in the same population. And that is, to some extent, a case where a certain mutation is not completely adapted. It's only partly adapted.
So we'll take one more question. I'm sure we can deal with other ones in the pub afterwards. Yeah.
What I've got to say, human being can develop instinct, because I put it this way, anybody that goes in a dangerous life might be a policeman, gangster, soldier. Now I remember being down in a mine and was at the coal face, and it was just as well, there's about three of us there. All of a sudden, this bloke, he'd been at in the coal face for years, he said, "Get back," he said, "there's going to be a fall." My God, there was a fall too. A good lot of stone came down. We would have been to kingdom come if we didn't get back.
Yeah, well, of course, this is an example, not of instinct, but of learned behaviour. The man that had been working at the coal face for all these number of years was able to distinguish the telltale sounds and whatever else it was that was telltale before the newcomers who knew nothing about it. They had no reaction, but the man who'd been learning by experience did. Now, this is not an instinctive reaction. This is not determined by a built-in programming, because instinctive reaction happens irrespective of external factors. It doesn't necessarily have to rely on external factors. I know that it's suggested that very often instinct is sparked off by external factors, but the kind of instinctive programming these people are talking about is something which will happen in any case, particularly aggression. I mean, if somebody is genetically aggressive, then they'll be genetically aggressive all the time. It'll always be a factor in any circumstance.
Any other final point? All right. I'd like to thank you for coming.